My name is Perry Goldlust, and I'm going to be representing Mr. Falcone today. May it please the court, when we had the initial argument, the question was, what is the legal standard to be used to measure whether or not Mr. Falcone's work was in fact related, was in fact something that would make him an employee of the Certified Auto? I was asked by the court whether there was a bright line that would say this person is an independent contractor and this person is an employee. I could not find a bright line, and I still don't think there was a bright line. I think that the matters are very fact-intensive. I think that there's no way of escaping the sifting of the facts. The court in White versus Gulf Oil made that point in saying that you have to sift the facts. They also made the point that it is the right to have control over what an employee does or person does rather than whether you exercise the actual right. And that becomes a very significant point in the question of the word control. Larson uses an example, I have a right to tell a truck driver that works for me what speed limits. But if the driver doesn't follow the speed limits, that's my responsibility as the employer. But if I give a package to UPS, what speed they drive at is not my responsibility. It's the question of, do I have a right to control? When you look at the Lester Newton line of cases and the cases that I believe that should be decided under the restatement, the Lester Newton line of cases uses more of the tort type of issue of control. Do I have the power, the right to control what the person does? Not necessarily did I control that specific event, but did I have the right? Was the agent working within that area or span of control? When we come to the cases that I'm referring to, it is not so much the control. It is really the integration of the employee into the total operation of the business. The person that works in another example that has been used, I think it's in the restatement, says of a cook, you don't control what the cook makes and how the cook makes it in a restaurant, but the cook is still an employee. You're not controlling every aspect of what they do. So when the restatement goes through the analysis, they look at the questions of the integration of the person into the general work of this putative employer. Now, there's also a logic if you look at the purposes of our statute. Our purposes of our statute is to move the cost of industrial accidents to the customer. And it's a shifting of costs. It's saying that the best way to allocate the cost of industrial accidents is through the price that's charged the customer for the ultimate product. Therefore, when you begin the analysis of what did Mr. Falcone do, it seems to me by using the standards set out by the restatement a little more clear than simply the use of the analysis in Lester Newton. One of the key questions that's raised in the restatement is the facilities. Can a person perform the work without the facilities that is provided by the putative employer? Can you practice the trade there? And I have argued that Mr. Falcone cannot work on automobiles if he doesn't have a garage, if he doesn't have a power lift, if he doesn't have somebody that supplies the customers. When I go through the kind of occupation, and I want to make one other point, the board put heavy emphasis on the use of the word tools. And again, the restatement says tools sometimes are and sometimes aren't. It depends upon what the person is doing. And when you look at the instrumentalities to perform the job, that goes well beyond the issue of the tools. Mr. Falcone has no way of transferring any costs of industrial accidents to his customers. He doesn't have a customer. He only works for somebody. And the person that establishes, and here we go back to the issue of control, the person that establishes the general control of the workplace, who has the right to control the workplace, has been undisputedly Certified Auto. They set the hours that the store was open. They controlled the flow of customers. They determined the order of which the work was to be done. They determined that you were not supposed to have any lunch hour, supposed to work through your lunch hour. That is an exercise of control, but it also is an indication that Certified Auto was setting the rules under which the work was to be performed. Certified Auto maintained the inventory of the supplies that was needed to do the job. Certified Auto controlled how many hours the customer was going to be billed by their computer program. And it seems that if you look at the integration of what Mr. Falcone did at that job site and the total operation of Certified Auto, Certified Auto was maintaining the business. It was not Mr. Falcone that was maintaining a separate and independent business.
Well, you're having us look at the facts in the absence of a writing. Is it theoretically possible that they could, you know, that the employer, the owner of the business, I don't want to use employer, and the owner of the business could say, look, health insurance is expensive, pensions are expensive, you know, paying all sorts of things for employees are expensive. And what I want to do is simply contract with several people in writing to be independent contractors with the understanding they get a fixed amount per day and no benefits. And is that theoretically possible?
Justice Jacobs asked that question last time, and I had said no, and then I spent the last several weeks trying to figure out how I could employ somebody. I have the controls of the statute that says I can't contract around the statute. So then the thought came to me, well, sure, you just go to one of the job placement services and you say, I want to have a dozen people work in my facility, and you're the employer, and I pay a flat rate. That's one way. If you're asking me on a one-to-one basis, then it becomes, for me, much more difficult to find a way to get around that. I certainly think you can employ somebody and say, no health insurance, no life insurance. I guess there's certain ERISA rules as to how you treat the rest of the people. You can, but when it comes to the questions of certain statutory requirements, I don't think the law allows the shifting of the industrial accident away from the putative employer, using employer in a general sense.
Right. Well, what's the significance of the term we see in the briefs that the payments were under the table? I couldn't quite understand that. I realize you debate sending him this 1099 or whatever the form was after the accident occurred. But to the extent we have notations in a book that say I paid X dollars on these occasions, and then you do send the person, the individual, and the IRS a form that says we paid $6,400, that doesn't seem to me under the table in a negative sense. And are you suggesting under the table meant in this case, we really know you're an employee, but we're going to pay you cash, and we're not going to do the withholding and all of that stuff because I don't want you to be an employee?
Mr. Coombs said he did not want an employee because he was afraid of a back problem. So he said he didn't want an employee. Under the table has, at least in the workman's compensation cases that I've read, has been somebody who was paid without taxes. It was a way of avoiding or evading employment taxes for both the employee and the employer.
So normally you wouldn't be sending out 1099?
Presumably not, since you do not want to indicate any of that arrangement. This case, the 1099 came after he filed. Well, presumably if you're going to say he's not an employee and you have paid him, then you better give him a 1099 to bolster your position that he's not an employee. That's what we've looked at, the way many people get paid, and we've said that there is, in fact, I think this court has said that it's an uneven bargaining situation. The employer says, this is what I want to give you. You want to work for me? It's my way or the highway. And the employee says, yeah, I'll go. Or no, I'll work at that rate. And that's what Mr. Falcone said. And that's why I think our law says that you can't bargain away your workman's compensation protections. And I think that that's the, if you look at our theory of saying somebody's going to pay for the industrial accident, either the person's going to show up in the emergency room with no insurance, or the cost is going to be factored into the product that the customer buys. And I think that that's where the workman's compensation law said we should be interpreting it liberally and we should be looking for coverage.
Mr. Goldust, if I understand what you're saying right, correctly, what I'm hearing is that that you're proposing, and maybe that's too strong a word, as a rule of thumb, that if the putative employee has a business of his own or her own, no matter how small, that can be used to shift to the consuming public the costs of workman's compensation, then that arrangement, that is the arrangement that we have in this case, might well be an independent contractor relationship. But if the putative employee doesn't have the ability to do that,
there are contract welders that work at many different sites. They have their own business. They are independent contractors. They are told, you're going to weld this part of the sewer pipe, the boardwalk. When that job is finished, they move on to the next job.
With their equipment, with that, with.
But they have a business license.
Right.
They have a business.
Right.
The fact that somebody is an itinerant laborer and moves from place to place as jobs are available, it's hard for me to characterize that person as having, well, you know, you're a shelf stocker. That's your profession. And you go from supermarket to supermarket, depending upon who wants to hire you. I would find that to be difficult to say that person maintains a business. If the person works for the same...
Well, before we leave the shelf stocker, so under your scenario, if you go from Food Lion to Super Fresh to Super G, all these different places stocking shelves, and you're injured in any one of those places, you would say they would be eligible for workers' compensation?
At the place where the law says that, where it was that you had the accident. If it was at Food Lion, it was Food Lion.
Right, because that would be an employment at will relationship, however short.
Yeah, if I was a refrigerator repair person and I went from store to store, and I had my own truck and my own tools, and I finished the repair work, and I moved on to the next store. No, I don't think that person is an employee. That's not the type of industrial accident that we're talking about.
So you couldn't say to someone, I'll pay you $80 a day to stock my shelves. And I want you to understand, you're not an employee. I'm just paying you $80 a day. You'll probably be here 3 or 4 days.
I do not think that you can do that, no. I think that our legislation says that we don't care how you pay them. You can't avoid the cost of an industrial accident just by the benediction of saying you're not an employee. I don't think, and I think the cases that I've read said that the employment status is not a function of necessarily of contract, exclusively of contract, because there is a statute that intervenes that says that you can't create such a contract.
Mr. Golust, should we continue to consider the standard to be the four elements that Lester Newton Trucking describes when we determine whether a worker is an employee for the purposes of workers' compensation, or should we use the eight factors that are listed in the restatement?
I believe...
I know it's a long, almost... too long question, but whichever you pick, can you tell me whether there's sufficient evidence in the findings of the Industrial Accident Board to support their conclusion or not?
I do not believe that the Lester Newton standards should be used, because I think that they are primarily useful in a different set of circumstances, distinguishing between two putative employees, perhaps even distinguishing on the matter of a tort. I think that the restatement should be used. And I think that with the analysis of the restatement, I think the board's analysis of the facts were so cursory as to be not providing substantial evidence. I think that they did not go through the analysis that is required, and I believe the facts were there. The facts were clearly established that if you use the standards and you follow what they are requiring, is there an integration with the work of the employer?
So when it's one putative employer and one putative employee, the cleanest and most thorough way to look at it is to find facts that address each of the eight restatement factors. Is that your position?
That is my position, sir.
And in this case, you do not believe that the record before us supports a conclusion that that is, in fact, what the Industrial Action Report did, and therefore they should be reversed?
I do not believe that they followed the restatement. I believe that they did not properly read the restatement, and my example was that they used the word tools but not the instrumentality of the work. I think that they used the word control in an improper way. It was the matter of, did he control how he fixed the car, or does the putative employer have the right to control how the car gets fixed and what gets done?
But setting aside,
let me make sure my question, excuse me, it's fair then to read your answer to be yes.
Yes, I believe the board used the wrong standards, and yes, I believe there's sufficient evidence to reverse the board.
Well, what I'd like to ask, is the record sufficiently complete that if one decides to apply the restatement, that based on the factual findings of the board, that the restatement can be applied?
Yes, I believe so. I think that in
what would be the outcome under the restatement?
That Mr. Falcone would be found to be an employee. I believe that in my briefs and in my arguments, I have been setting out the facts that were undisputed.
Didn't the Superior Court come out the other way? And the Superior Court seemed to suggest, and let's assume the focus should have been the restatement. If I look at the board's decision, meaning the Superior Court, and I apply 220, I think we can affirm. And you're suggesting that was the wrong conclusion.
Yes, because I think the Superior Court and the Industrial Accident Board used the word control did not use the word control in the concepts of 220, as you call it. They used it in the concept more of the Lester Newton or tort. Did you control when he put the tire on? Did you control him putting the tire on? Therefore, you have respondent superior responsibility. As opposed to, did you control the workplace? Did you control the rate and flow of the work? And I think that what it turned on is the word control, but the definition is different. Thank you.
May it please the Court, Susan List on behalf of the appellee, Coombs & Coombs, Inc. I do agree with Mr. Goldlust that there's no bright-line standard here. It's a highly factual standard, and that each case needs to be looked at on the factual basis of the case before it. Based upon that assumption and that hard, fast rule, I think the board's decision must be affirmed because the board is the ultimate trier of facts.
And then when you say there's no standard, are we going to stick with Lester Newton and look at four considerations, or are we going to go to Restatement 220, you know, with the additional considerations? Which do you think is the proper analysis?
As of right now, the way the case law is before the court right now, I believe Lester Newton is the appropriate standard. I think it would not be harmful for the board, as it did in this situation, to look at some of the other factors, such as the restatement factors. But I think the case law, which identifies Section 20, 22-220 as being dispositive that Fishers versus Townsend is a different factual scenario. You're talking about respondent superior. You're talking about vicarious liability. In that case, it specifically notes at footnote 7 in the case that when you're looking at the issue of eligibility for workers' compensation benefits, it's the Lester Newton factors that are dispositive in this case. That being said, there's case law dating back to Gooden versus Mitchell, which enumerates some of the factors set forth in the restatement. The right to control is a factor under either standard. The distinct occupation of either the employer or the employee, the skill required, who supplied the tools, the length of employment, the method of payment, these are all factors which have long been recognized by this court as demonstrative of whether or not there is an employer relationship or whether there's an independent contract relationship.
Let's assume for the sake of argument that this court concludes that the restatement factors in cases of this kind, one single putative employer, one single putative employee, determining whether that employee is eligible for workers' comp. The eight factors listed in the restatement should be addressed in an opinion of the IAB. Were they in this case explicitly or implicitly addressed, and why?
They were implicitly and in some parts explicitly addressed. Specifically, under whatever factor you utilize, it's the right to control that is the most important factor. And the board specifically identified that, and they spent, I think it was two or three pages of their decisions looking at the right to control. And if the right to control is not the right to control the means but the end result, any employer or any agent always has the right to see whether the job is done correctly. It's whether they or not have the actual means to control the actual job duties where we're looking at. The board noted here that Mr. Falcone could come and go as he pleased. I know that was a disputed fact before the board, but it was a disputed fact that the board found in favor of appellee. That is, they found that Mr. Coombs' testimony that Mr. Falcone could come and go as he pleased. He got paid $80 a day. $80 a day whether or not he worked till 6 o'clock at night, whether he worked till 7 o'clock at night, or whether they didn't have enough work for him to stay the whole day and he left at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. He still got $80 a day. The board also noticed that Mr. Falcone was given the right to diagnose problems that came in with the automobiles. They would turn to a customer would come in and say, my car's not starting, and Mr. Coombs would allow Mr. Falcone not only the right to figure out what that problem is, but he trusted them on that. And he had actually passed those costs on to the customer based upon whatever Mr. Falcone found that was wrong. He never directed the manner in which there was no procedures which set forth, this is how we change the oil in the car, this is how we diagnose a starter problem. And I think that dovetails with another factor, and that's the skill required, which the board specifically addressed. And a higher skill favors an independent contractor for obvious reasons.
But not necessarily. I mean, take the hypothetical of the sous chef at a restaurant, a French restaurant. Nobody's going to tell the chef, how to plan the menu or how to make sure how to prepare the food.
And I agree.
The chef is an employee.
Does he have to be, though? I don't think he has to be. I think the Four Seasons, a hotel that has a very well-known restaurant as part of that hotel. Why can't they hire out an independent contractor? Come in, do what you need to do. Why can't they do that?
Well, if the you asked a rhetorical question, I'll answer it. If the chef has his own catering service and a bevy of similarly talented people who go out and do that, that may be right. But then that chef would be the operator of an independent business, correct?
I don't think it needs to be an independent business. I don't think the workers' compensation statute, specifically permits independent contractors. It doesn't say the independent contractor has to be licensed, employed on their own business. It recognizes that independent contractors do exist and that there is no entitlement to workers' compensation benefits if you're an independent contractor.
Go ahead.
the issue here is this claimant an independent contractor?
I agree, and I think the board properly went through the factors, whether it's the restatement factors or the Lester Newton factors, and found him not to be an employee but to be an independent contractor.
I'm curious about a slightly different aspect to this problem. We have the one issue as to what the proper standard is, and we know what perhaps traditionally has been applied, and there's a suggestion that the restatement is the more appropriate standard under these kinds of facts. My concern is this. There are, I think, eight factors in the restatement, and I have no doubt but that the board would hear evidence and would make factual determinations on, for example, the extent to which the master exercises control, or the skill required, what items are supplied, how payments are made, and so forth. Is it also up to the board, with deference given to the board, the way it is with respect to factual determinations, is it also the case that the board, after it finds various facts and says, okay, we've looked at all these things, we decide that overall this makes you an independent contractor, is that conclusion also to be reviewed by the standard of substantial evidence, even though it's a legal decision that they're making?
I do believe it is, because a lot of the factors involved are highly factual factors. I think once the standard is established, applying those standards to the facts of a case is a factual scenario. And once that factual scenario is rendered by the board, I think that great deference has to be given to the board. And there's case law even out there that says, whether a claimant doesn't fit clearly into an independent contractor relationship or an employee relationship, that is always a question of fact. It is never a question of law, and I think that's right. And I think it's difficult in cases such as this when you're talking about a mom-and-pop type shop and an individual. But there's one comment I wanted to make in comment to Mr. Goldlust's that this uneven bargaining power, I don't think that's necessarily the case in this factual scenario. Mr. Falcone was employed at the time these discussions started. Mr. Falcone was working as a chef or a cook in a restaurant. His testimony was he approached Mr. Coombs to discuss the possibility of Mr. Coombs employing him or taking him on in some manner, because he used to work as a mechanic, although he had not been in that mechanic industry for a couple of years. I don't know if you have the same uneven bargaining power. If you look at the facts of this case, Mr. Falcone went to work for Mr. Coombs at a lesser pay rate, under the table, not under the table. I think that's a disputed fact on how that was paid that was also resolved in favor of my client below. I don't think you have the uneven bargaining power. Mr. Falcone was looking to get something out of this. Mr. Coombs was looking to get out something out of this. Mr. Coombs was looking to get a partner to turn the business over to somebody. It's an independent contract relationship based upon that. I think when you also look at the supply of the tools, I agree with Mr. Goldlust that there were tools supplied by the employer and there were tools supplied by Mr. Falcone. Mr. Falcone brought in several $1,000 worth of tools that he had had over the years. He also purchased between $6,000 and $7,000 of additional tools in conjunction with his involvement with Coombs and Coombs.
But that's not unusual for mechanics to own their own tools, though.
It's not unusual for mechanics to own their own tools, but I would like to compare it to a dental hygienist. Plenty of dental hygienists these days are not working as employees of dentists, but as independent contractors, where they'll work 1 or 2 days with one dentist and then 2 or 3 days with another dentist. They're independent contractors. The dentist still provides the chair. This dentist still schedules the appointments of the patients, and I don't think that's really that much different from what we have here. You have the lift being supplied You have the scheduling of appointments. Obviously, there has to be some scheduling of appointments in this type of industry where you're fixing cars. I think that's a similar factual scenario. The hygienists might bring their own tools, which obviously would not be very, it would be custom in that trade also. But I think when you're talking about a substantial investment, if you look at it, the $6,000 to $7,000 in tools that he paid out was more than the wages that he was paid in 2003 by Coombs & Coombs. He was only paid $6,400. I think that's a factual scenario which needs to be taken into account. The method of payment is highly relevant in this manner. There was no overtime paid. There was no vacation paid. There was no sick time paid. He was paid, as I said, $80 per day, whether he worked a couple hours or whether he worked overtime or extended lengths of time.
But isn't the type of payment inconsistent with independent contracting in the sense that he's not getting paid by the job? He's getting paid by the day.
The board examined that issue, and the board felt in total that the method of payment favored an independent contract relationship. They did note that independent contract relationships more are likely to be paid by the job or to be paid in conjunction with the submission of an invoice. But that wasn't the fact here. But he was paid by the day, which the board said in a flat lump sum rate. They felt that more likely demonstrated an independent contractor relationship.
But is that consistent with the restatement?
I think it is consistent with the restatement. I think it'd be difficult in this type of industry to pay them by the job, to pay an individual by the job. You could say, Mr. Coombs could have said, I'll pay you X amount of dollars for a oil repair. I will pay you Y amount of dollars in the event that you're diagnosing a starter issue. But the way the program is run in this, he passes on the costs of the labor to the customers. So I think the $80 a day, regardless of how many hours are worked or how many projects he completed that day, I think that's fair, and I think that was a method of payment which could be seen as supportive of the independent contractor relationship.
Okay, I hear your argument, but I'm looking at the restatement. It says method of payment, whether by time or by the job. This was not by the job. It was by time. Therefore, under that element of the restatement, he's an employee.
I think
now, that may not be dispositive because there are other elements, but you're saying it was okay for the Industrial Accident Board to say, oh, well, you know, even though there were no invoices and even though he wasn't paid by the job, we're saying that his method of payment supports a conclusion that he was an independent contractor. How do you take facts that seem to be the opposite of what the restatement says and then say, well, but it's okay because the board took those facts and put them on the other side of the equation?
I don't think the issue is just pay by the job versus pay on a time basis. I think the case law out there has established that also relevant factors are the fact whether or not overtime is paid, vacation time is paid, whether sick pay is given. Those are all relevant factors under the restatement and under the case law, especially the Gooden versus Mitchell case law. So while as the payment by the day may seem to weigh in favor of an employee relationship, the fact that he was not paid overtime, he was not paid sick time, was not paid vacation time, weighs in favor of an independent contractor relationship. And therefore, I think the board properly held, and the board said very specifically, the method of payment is an ambiguous factor. We believe, you know, and they listed those exact factors that you just outlined as being more favorable of an employee contract relationship as opposed to the independent contractor. But when they looked in the situation in total, and as you suggested, in conjunction with the other factors that they were to identify, including the restatement factors, they felt that the totality of the circumstances was an independent contractor relationship. I think it's also is important, although obviously not dispositive under the case law, is the beliefs of the party, the relative to beliefs of the party. And there was obviously a dispute as to that, but once again, that was a factual dispute that was resolved in favor of my client. Mr. Coombs testified that he wanted to bring on an independent contractor. Mr. Falcone believed that he was being paid under the table as an employee. Once again, I have some suspect, and there was credibility determinations made by the board relative to that, because Mr. Falcone did leave his employer at a restaurant, which he was making more wages. He was going to work for a mechanic, and he wanted to get something out of it. So I would say that the relative beliefs of the party are extremely important in this type of matter. And there's a host of factors that the board noted favored the employee relationship, especially the fact that it's not a distinct occupation or a distinct type of business. But once again, the totality of the circumstances, as the Superior Court noted, even if you apply the restatement factors, you're going to come out on the fact that this man was an independent contractor, not an employee. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes.
I want to draw the distinction on the definition of control, because I think, while I made the point in my opening statement, the control is not whether or not somebody tells him how to repair or change the oil. That's something he has the skill. That's why he was hired. The question is, who has the right to control it from the standpoint of, this is my business. This is what I charge for an oil change. This is the materials you use, and this is the amount of time you can spend on it. That's another form of control. The employer does not have to actually exercise the control on every turn of the wrench to make somebody an employee. The question of wages, we do have a statute that says that wages, in terms of our workman's compensation law, can be paid by the hour or can be paid by the day. It can also be paid by piece rate. So we do define wages very broadly. We also, going to the question of the restatement, there are many places where the board just seems to have ignored the issue. And one of them that has not been discussed today is the length of time a person works for the same employer. This gentleman worked several months for this employer. And that should not mitigate towards an independent contractor. That should be an indication a person comes to work every day and the hours of work are set. And to stretch this into being an independent contractor that comes every day for 5-6 months becomes a little bit more difficult. My colleague also raised the issue of mental hygienists, and that totally confused me since that's not the subject before us. We don't have the terms of the employment, and I don't know of any case law that defines dental hygienist as being one or the other. So I don't think pointing to that offers the court very much of assistance. And I thank you, court, for the attention.
Thank you. We'll take the case under advisement and adjourn.
Please rise.